This podcast is brought to you by The Shift.
Hello there, big apologies for the unexpected hiatus in release dates. We recorded this intro about a month ago, but unfortunately due to life admin, illness and holidays, a lot got in the way, but we are finally getting it out now, so enjoy.
Welcome to another episode of The Last One to See. Kate, it's Cannes week, but I feel like the two of us didn't really get too involved because we were in other climes.
Yeah, we're not really in the Riviera orbit. So like if you are here for your hot button Cannes topics, I'm sorry, we're not really here for them. Because David, you were sunning yourself, emphasis on sunning, because you got a little rouge, Babs.
Yeah, no, this isn't just all like fake tan and good lighting here. I definitely would say that I got a little bit of a patchy burn on day one, that some heavy moisturizing and a heavy SPF over the rest of the holiday evened it out. And I think I have a nice healthy post-holiday glow at this point.
And where did this holiday take place? I immediately went to tell everyone about your sunburn.
Gran Canaria. So I was in Las Palmas. Where were you in these recent times?
I've been in physical locations, but also like a spiritual place, and that place is Wedfest 2022.
Excellent.
So I am coming to you 2/3 of the way into the 3 weddings in 4 weeks that I'm doing. So wedding number one was the beautiful Jen marrying the very lucky Dan in Birmingham. My beloved Steve was not only a groomsman, but an excellent flair boy. So if anyone needs such a person
to
round out their wedding party, I will accept all reasonable offers, or even some unreasonable ones if they're funny. So yeah, that was fabulous. And it was here in Birmingham, beautiful venue called The Distillery, which is an old gin distillery right on the canal, which, in case I haven't mentioned this in this podcast, and I almost definitely have, Birmingham has more canals than Venice, so suck it, Italy.
Shocker.
So that was stunning. And then Steve and I hot-footed it over to Ireland for the wedding of my beloved baby sister, Anna. Did I cry? Yes. Did she yell at me not to while we were getting ready and that stopped me getting too emotional? Also, yes. And she was right to do so. So yeah, another stunning wedding. I was one of 4 bridesmaids on the 50% who were not pregnant. So yeah, shout out to my other sister Beth and Emily for the bumps they're packing, both girls. So female supremacy continues. And Anna's wonderful sister-in-law, Jill. I was about to say my sister-in-law, because I also now kind of feel like we are
all
family.
Adopted her, yeah.
Yeah, basically. She only has a brother. So we're like, hey,
brilliant.
We have an excess of sisters. One more would make a difference. Yeah, so absolutely fabulous weekend. Just delighted to have my brother-in-law, Connor, Anna and Connor have been together for 10 years.
Wow.
So, like, he's always been family, yeah. Really. But now we have the bit of paper to prove it. And we have a fallow weekend this weekend, which is quite nice. I am working on Sunday at a rugby-related shoot. So it's basically all of my interests together at once. And then we return across the water to my friend Dave and his beautiful bride Elizabeth are getting married. I am a groomsman. I don't know, do I say groomsperson, groomswoman, groomsindividual, whatever you're having yourself. Yeah, and I have a reading to do, which, guys, I am going to practice. Haven't done it yet. Will do, promise. It is in Tipperary. So Steve got to say it's a long way to Tipperary.
Hey.
It was possibly the highlight of his life. So yeah, I kind of feel, as we said, we haven't been particularly on Cannes and I haven't particularly been watching much. Got in the finale, I suppose. I kind of feel there was 2 finales to Derry Girls. There was the finale of the series proper,
yeah.
And then there was like kind of the hour long.
The 1 year later special that could have actually been released a year later, but they were like, we'll do it the day later.
Yeah, I kind of, listen, I adore Derry Girls. Sometimes I get annoyed if I don't think Steve is finding it sufficiently funny, but he is a wee English fella, so we let it go. But I do kind of feel like they've really wanted to draw a line under it, because obviously Nick McLaughlin has become insurmountably famous and I think Lisa McGee is ready to move on. The cast are all kind of doing different things. Like I saw Dylan Whelan, as I think you pronounce that, Pistol, the new Sex Pistols. I was about to say documentary, that's obviously a filthy lie,
yeah.
Because it's not a documentary, but dramatization.
Bio series.
Yeah, exactly. And like directed by Danny Boyle, which is very interesting. And like, I really like Thomas Brodie Sangster as well. He's playing Malcolm McLaren in it, even though he has, and like, I don't know what Malcolm McLaren actually sounded like, but for an English man, mm-hmm. Thomas has put on a very strange English accent.
Okay.
So maybe he has an English accent, I don't know. And then, yeah, Maisie Williams, another obviously Game of Thrones alum in there. So that's going to be really interesting to see. And then obviously, like, all the gals seem to just be doing really interesting projects. And obviously, you know, your queen and mine, Siobhan McSweeney's sister Michael, is out, whether it be the Great Pottery Throwdown, whether it be doing like really strong work on stage.
Speaking of Nicola Coughlan, I'll be seeing her co-star from Bridgerton, Jonathan Bailey, is it? in Cock, which is a play happening in London.
Oh, I've heard great things.
So I'm flying over on Sunday till Tuesday to take in Jessie Ware in concert after having seen her in podcast form earlier in the month with you, and then theatre on Monday night. So a little double bill before my next double bill in London, which is the 15th to the 17th of June, when I'm going over for the PC Music Volume 3 album launch and Sky Ferreira's concert.
And to bring it back to Derry Girls, what were your thoughts on the series finale and then kind of our capping off our 1 hour special?
I will say that I had the kind of reaction at the end of the season finale one, when Nicola Coughlan's character, I'm so bad with the names of their characters.
Claire.
Yes. Claire, of course. So Claire gets her kiss at the end of that episode. And then shortly after then, obviously, spoilers abound, her father dies in the show. And I think it pulled up for me one of those kind of like slightly older gay tropes of when there's a moment of gay joy experience that has to be countered with a sort of negative backlash in some way. And it's something where there's like elements of the show that it's been kind of progressive, and it's especially kind of like the time period that's set in and showing kind of like a lesbian character and everything, that like harking back to some of those older tropes was a little bit disappointing or something to me. But I think that like there's a lot of juxtaposition that happens throughout the show, and we think you talked about that when we were texting.
Yeah, we did, because this was one of the things that obviously you text me about. And firstly, I am aware I am not a queer person, so I was like, it's not something that occurred to me, but I can 100% see why it would occur to you. But my point back to you was, I think it's always a show that has combined, like, I think most famously the scene where they're doing the like step aerobics routine intercut with the parents watching footage of a bombing.
Mm.
I think that is always something that they've done. And I do think, obviously, if you have been watching the third series, this is blatantly clear, and I think they've been very open about this, that Nicola Coughlan was not available for a lot of things.
She was on her own for so many shoots.
And they did it really well, like the thing where she misses a train and whatever, and that becomes a story and is very funny, and it's her sister Michael and Amy Huberman
as a
sex-positive train receptionist, whatever her job was. But I kind of felt like this was to give her some heavy lifting to do on both of those things. And I will say, like, you know, thankfully I have not lost a parent, but I haven't lost friends too, in particular, very unexpectedly. And that is what happens. Like, you are living your life, and like, God willing, you are living your best life where you've just made out with a hot girl, but like, your legs get taken out from under you. And I have to say, I thought Tommy Tiernan played it
fantastic.
And it is in, and we did comment as well that he is also currently a dad in Conversations with Friends, which I've only seen the first two episodes of, so I think we probably won't go into.
Yeah, I haven't dipped into that yet.
But like, he's really cornering the Irish dad market and the excellent chat show host market as well. So truly, it's the Tiernan-a-sons. So yeah, because so much of his character is almost the black velvet that the rest of the family shines on, because obviously his interactions with the dad, his interactions with his wife, his interactions with Aunt Sarah, he's so much
set up,
the straight man. Which, ironically, given he is, you know, a comedian, and probably still best known for a comedian, as soon as he walked in, you were just like, oh God. There was a beautiful moment with Claire's father where he looks at her and you can see how proud he is of her when they're all like getting in the car dressed as swans/angels. It was like that moment again, to go back to kind of the high and low, where the grandfather, who is always putting the father down, they're watching this bombing on TV and he puts his hand on his shoulder and you don't need to say a lot.
Mm.
And I think Derry Girls is so good, both comedically and in terms of emotional punch, of doing a lot with so little, whether it be like one really well-timed one-liner.
And even physical humor, I think they were so like harking back
reactions
to that style of, yeah.
Yeah, I probably, and maybe it is, I really enjoyed the 1 hour special in terms of like, you know, the Good Friday Agreement is 98. I do remember it, and I do remember like just obviously I could not vote because I was 12, but like I do remember that massive positivity and that massive sense of relief. And I, you know, so I do remember it. Like, it was interesting to talk to Steve about it, because I was like, because for me, like, it was a massively dominant thing.
Yeah.
Like, we all knew what it was.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas, like, I think here, it was more something they were vaguely aware of.
Foreign news headlines.
Now,
like,
he is 2 years younger than me, obviously, so, like, I don't think he was a wildly politically aware 10-year-old. I found it really interesting, and I found, like, they did their best or whatever, but for me, like, I think it didn't quite reach the heights that the series finale did, both comedically, because it was hilarious. Yeah. Like, even when James rips up the Fat Boy Slim tickets or whatever. I kind of felt like, as well, I love Sister Michael. I would worship at the church of Sister Michael, but I kind of feel like they're running out of things to do with her a little bit.
Yeah. The we're going to move you on and her standing up for herself thing was a little bit of a slow story or something. It didn't pop the way that it was, like, they could have made it a bit more chaotic or fun.
And I think obviously the relationship that she has with the priest is really interesting, because the impression I get, both from a slight underlying vibe and also from, you know, her Instagram, is they are in real life tremendous pals.
Oh, okay.
So I think the, like, inherent tension where she just makes it very clear that she thinks he's an absolute gobshite.
Yeah.
And I also deeply admire the commitment to giving him horrible hair in this series, because he's a very handsome man.
Yeah, the giving him ponytail.
That horrendous ponytail,
I think
is actually quite funny.
But anyway, speaking of men with ponytails, we probably should get onto this week's movie.
Oh, my, there's not a shortage of men with hair. So to circle back to the topic of which we know nothing, there was an announcement made that we were only delighted to hear, because it was very timely.
Very
timely. This podcast. David, can you tell us more?
So at Cannes, there was talk of a This Is Spinal Tap sequel. So this has been buzzed for quite a while. Kind of, there's been,
I think, literally since it came out almost, but it's now, I feel like there has been more concrete talk about it recently.
There was a DVD commentary recorded a couple of years ago that I feel that spurred a lot of rumors around then, because they dropped into character during the commentary and was very much a kind of thing of like, oh, these guys can still do it. Like, there's a
chance. And that they've kept touring in these characters consistently.
Yeah.
And who are these characters, David?
What? The characters of This Is Spinal Tap. So the movie is a 1984 classic and was directed by
Rob Reiner. And he also cameos in it, but he was originally an actor. The streak he had and the things that he has directed are incredible, like truly incredible. His mother, I think, is, you know, the Harry Met Sally that I'll Have What She's Having.
So shocker, I've never seen Harry Met Sally.
Who's coming on the podcast to talk about when Harry Met Sally?
I know, someone please.
Have you seen The Princess Bride?
Yes, yes. Check on
Thank God. Also, anyone who has not seen The Princess Bride,
would love to discuss.
He's one of those people that when you know who he is, and obviously, like, he's a very famous director, so it's not a surprise. Like, he turns up in random things like The First Wives Club, you know, stuff like, he's Jess's dad in New Girl. Post Spinal Tap, the streak that he went on is quite incredible. And David, who is joining us to discuss this masterpiece?
We have the wonderful Andrea Cleary. You may know her from her work. She has written for many publications, including The Irish Times. She does Nine or Nine's podcast. She has her own podcast, My Favorite Album with Andrea Cleary, and she, the season two of that just started a couple of weeks back as well, so in full swing with that one.
She's also sometimes co-host of Juvenilia. We had two of her fellow hosts, Alan and Sarah, on the previous episode talking about But I'm a Cheerleader, so I think it's nice to complete the Juvenilia triumvirate, if that is how you say that word. So you know one of those words that you see written down and you know what it is, but then you go to say it out loud, you're like, I've overcommitted here.
A triumvirate? I feel that was used in Buffy once. Is that the word we're using?
Yeah, possibly. Who even knows? So yeah, I don't think we should crack on too much longer, because one of our favourite things about Spinal Tap was its brevity. So yes. Let's try and take a leaf out of that book and leave you with This Is Spinal Tap. We're delighted to be joined by freelance music and culture journalist Andrea Cleary. She is booked and busy across the Sunday Business Post, RTÉ Arena, and the Irish Times, just to name a few. She is the podcast host of My Favourite Album over on Tall Tales. She's co-hosting the Nine or Nine podcast. She's a noted Twitter absconder, which is understandable given she clearly has no time whatsoever. And a survivor, as a survivor of the OG indie sleaze era, Andrea, how do you feel about it coming back?
I'm so excited. Oh my God. I can't remember who it was that was sharing that there are waistcoats back on the high street. Like, I'm just waiting until the day when I'm out and I see like a 20-year-old woman wearing a bow tie. And then I'm like, we're back, baby. We're in.
With her 19-year-old boyfriend in a waistcoat.
Yeah. Yeah. Explaining music to her. Just like the good old days, like it used to be.
So this sartorial connoisseur is in fact Andrea Cleary, and she is the last one to see This Is Spinal Tap. Andrea, as a music journalist, how have you avoided this film?
I know, it's so I was thinking about, like, why have I not seen this film? And I think it was because so many of the guys I was friends with as a teenager, and a lot of my anxieties around, like, what I do and do not engage with in culture kind of, like, stemmed from this time in my life when I was hanging around with a lot of guys who liked music or whatever. And they all watched it and loved it. And I assumed, because they all watched it and loved it, that it was, like, really sexist and horrible to women or something. Do you know what I mean? I kind of just got the impression that maybe they were laughing at the bits that were maybe a bit more sexist. Now, obviously, I haven't seen the film and I don't know if those bits even exist, but I just always had it in my head that it was like a film for music guys and that there wasn't a lot of room for like women in it. Whereas now I know now that it is like a satire and we're supposed to be laughing at these guys and this type of guys.
So yeah, like what you know of it, like in terms of like the plot or anything, give us a quick rundown of what you've picked up kind of from the culture.
I think it's about an English, maybe like hair metal band or like a kind of a glam rock band that take themselves very, very seriously. And it's a documentary of them maybe either on the road or making an album or something like that, like leading up to some kind of big either performance or recording of the album or whatever. And that there's definitely songs in it, because I know one of the songs, which is called Big Bottoms, I want to say.
Are you sure you're not just thinking of Queen?
No, this is definitely a song in it, because my boyfriend was singing it one day. And the last line in the chorus is like, so he's singing about how much he loves big butts. And then the last line in the chorus is, how can I leave this behind? And I absolutely burst out laughing. I was like, what is that? He was like, it's Spinal Tap. And then I had like the shameful moment of, I've never seen Spinal Tap. And he was like, what? You have to see it. And then you guys got in touch like at the exact right time. I was like, okay, I'll do Spinal Tap for this. But yeah, so I know there's songs in it as well, and I know the, you know, the going up to 11 thing. That's it, really, honestly. I don't really know much else about it.
I was just thinking there as to what you were saying about it being, you know, like that it felt like at a point in your life that every man you knew had seen it and you hadn't seen it. Was it a pre sort of Anchorman where quoting it was a substitute for personality?
I think so. I think it was around the time when there was that very kind of, no, I mean, obviously, I think this film was made in like the 80s or something, but it was a time when, like, I don't know, humor was a bit, was a lot more spiky, we'll say. It was funny and acceptable to kind of make very sexist jokes and even maybe like racist jokes sometimes as well. Like just kind of edgy. That's the thing. It was edgy humor was in fashion at the time. And I just assumed that because edgy humor was in fashion and people liked this film, that they went hand in hand.
It's a product of the time kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. When I feel it now is like completely unfair to that film, which I gather from speaking to people about it is very clever and one of the best comedies of all time and basically like launched the mockumentary genre. So I'm so excited to kind of, or the mock rockumentary genre.
Mock rock docs.
Mock rock docs. So I can't wait to see.
And in terms of those kind of like mockumentary ones, are there any others that you'd be a fan of that you're kind of coming in with a bit of knowledge?
Mockumentary style? Not really in terms of film. I'm not the biggest sort of like film person is the thing. I'm really intimidated by talking about films.
We're a very safe space here.
But that's the thing. It's like, that's why I love the concept of this podcast so much, if I may. It's like, it's because I don't have to come in with like all of this knowledge or anything. I can just come in with like, here are my thoughts, you know. I love watching a film when it's happening, but I struggle to kind of like go and seek out films because I just feel like it's an area of the arts that is so like people really do decide what's good and what's bad in it.
Because I think a lot of people would feel that way about music. Mm. And especially if you are not musical like myself, that you would feel that you can't critique something. Seems like a very fancy word, but that you can't even have an opinion on something.
Music is a really interesting one because I think maybe even more so than film, but I'm saying this again as a kind of a non-film person, I think music is probably the most like personal of the arts. Like you listen to an album, if you love an album, you'll listen to it every day kind of thing, whereas if you love a film, you might necessarily. So albums and music kind of embed themselves like into your personality and into who they are.
And I think it can bleed into your life. You know, you can be doing what A, B, or C, whereas a film, like, you do kind of sit and engage with it as like a separate thing. Yeah. And obviously, like, film does, you know, influence fashion, does influence things like that. But I think music is just so ubiquitous in how it kind of bleeds into other parts of life and other parts of culture as well. But it just is interesting as someone who I would hope, Andrea, at this stage feels relatively confident in the music arena. But it is interesting that you're saying that you would find that there's things about film that you would find intimidating to engage with in the same way.
Even in terms of like music journalism and film journalism, like there's the surface level, like what you did you like or dislike the film? And everyone can kind of talk about that like surface level enjoyment. But it's when you get all the work that goes on behind the scenes. So like maybe production and music, but things like directing and writing. It's like, I think that's the stuff where that can get into the intimidating space.
Yes.
Being able to talk about how it was made as opposed to just like the thing that's in front of you.
That's exactly it. I remember I was having a drink with some friends and we were talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I really liked that film. I loved it actually. I thought it was a bit long, but you know, and I am a fan of Quentin Tarantino. I really like his films. And I was sitting at a table with who I would consider to be like my film friends. Like they're really, really into film and they kind of know everything and they know who directed this, that and the other. And I was like, oh, I really like that film. And then it was like an hour and a half of like, no, no, it's bad because of this. And I was like, oh, right. Okay, fine. But at the same time, I don't feel capable of critiquing films in the same way that I can critique music. Because I feel like there's a lot more in film that I just think is like magic. I'm so impressed when a film just gets made. The amount of people it takes to do their job properly, to get a film made, like not even good, just made. That's enough for me. All films are miracles. Like I think, I just think it's incredible. So if somebody watches like, I don't know, say like Lady Bird or something and they're like, oh no, I didn't like it because of this, that and the other. I'm like, it's an entire film with a plot and very good performances. And there was no mistakes. All the editing was right. Do you know what I mean? So that's where I'm coming at films from. Where I'm
everything was in the right order.
Everything was in the right order. They didn't leave out any scenes. Like, I'm really impressed by that.
I think you're touching on something really interesting there. And it's something that often comes up whenever I meet people who say they don't like the Beatles. And it's like, you cannot like the Beatles. But what you like and don't like is personal. But saying whether some, you cannot say the Beatles are not good.
Exactly.
So it sounds like to me that you said to this group of friends, I like this film, as you're entitled to. And they were like, this
that is
why
it's bad. Opinion.
Yeah.
But they're actually two separate things.
100%.
Good and bad is obviously somewhat subjective. I just don't put up with it when it comes to the Beatles.
Like the Beatles, I would say, are like maybe the only band that I'm like, no, they are objectively good. Like there's no, I won't hear people who say anything bad against them. They've written bad songs, but
it's when you start telling other people that they cannot like something.
That's part of the reason you mentioned that I'm a Twitter absconder. It's like part of the reason why I left it was around the time of the Don't Look Up discourse.
Sometimes when there is so much noise about something, and as you say, it's not just like, I don't know, say Yellow Jackets, where it's just like, oh, people are really into this, but it's just more like you have to have an opinion on what it all means.
Absolutely.
Certain opinions are right and wrong, as you say, like are valid and invalid, and then I just get a little bit fed up.
I do particularly like the likes of Twin Peaks, where it's so random that it's just like no one can really have a correct opinion on this because they've gone
absolutely
so left lane.
Yeah, I judge people who don't like Twin Peaks because I'm just like, I don't think you're meant to like it. Is the thing. I think you're meant to have it happen to you.
My Twitter header is that let people enjoy things meme. So it is something that I feel very strong about. And like, just like, I suppose it comes down to like most things in life that you don't get to force your opinion on other people, except when it comes to the Beatles. And then Andrea and I will come to your house. That's what
we will. We will come to your house. I think what it is for me is the modern idea that your opinion or what you like or don't like, and I think it is in film more than anything else, that it's a moral judgment on your character, that you have to pick a side, basically. Like when a big thing comes out, you have to decide whether it's good or bad, or why you think it's good or bad. There's a bit of it going on at the moment with Licorice Pizza, which I haven't seen yet, but I really like Paul Thomas Anderson, so I'll watch it. But I get to the stage where, and I say this all the time to my friends, to the point where they're like, okay, well, stop talking about it, where I'm just like, I'm going to watch this thing and I'm not going to talk to anyone about it. And they're like, okay, well, you don't have to announce it to us. And I'm like, well, just so you know. But I think it is, film is an easy one for a lot of people to have garbage opinions on. I do think music's a little bit harder because there's a bit more, like you were saying, there's a bit more of a barrier of access in terms of understanding production techniques and things like that. It's not as readily available. There's fewer kind of behind the scenes stuff.
But anyway,
we'll leave you to go watch the movie.
I'm very excited to watch it.
And have you back in studio to talk it all through. And before we jump to it, Kate, you have seen it before.
I have seen it, yeah.
And I also have.
I haven't seen it in at least 10 years.
Similarly, I teenage viewing and haven't revisited since. So it's a big refresh for me.
Okay, but, this is exciting. Great.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. There's a fiver on your desk for saying you like the podcast. So thank you for that. And we will talk to you very soon.
That's it for the preamble, so here is your courtesy warning that we're about to get into spoiler territory.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to this week's The Last One to See, where we are joined in studio, in person this time, by Andrea Cleary, who is now no longer the last person to see This is Spinal Tap.
I'm not, thank God.
And what did you think of the film is our first question.
I didn't expect to find it as funny as I did. I fully thought, I think we talked about this in the initial conversation we had about it, that I kind of felt going in that maybe I'd know basically all the jokes, but I think I knew maybe three jokes.
Wow.
And it is joke, 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 joke. Like, yeah, it's every few seconds something.
But I
funny
think how it's
so
done, it's not like Anchorman Flash for like, here's our big punchline. Like,
totally.
It is. Because it is a mockumentary, it is incredibly realistic in style. So it is these people very much inhabiting these characters and also taking what they're doing extremely seriously.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's not a comedy, you know?
Yeah.
It's incredibly funny, but it's not a comedy. It's not a comedic setup.
To rewind back, I suppose, obviously there's not a clear plot necessarily with this, maybe as much as other movies, but can you give us a quick summary of what you think the film is about?
Yes. So I now know what the film is about. I think I did okay in my initial kind of reading of what it was going to be, but having seen it now, This is Spinal Tap is a mock rockumentary about an English band called Spinal Tap, who are one of England's loudest bands.
I love
and,
that.
And it's made by a guy called Marty, who is played by Rob Reiner. And he basically wanted to make a documentary about the band's 1982 tour of the US to promote their album Smell the Glove. So basically they go, they do the documentary, they travel around America, and due to the band kind of maybe not keeping up with current tastes and internal fractions in the band, things start to go wrong. Their label doesn't want to put out their band because the cover is too sexist.
Which they think is sexy for a while.
Which they
very
think is sexy.
Yeah. They're like, why is it a bad thing to be too sexy?
What's wrong with being sexy? No, sexist. And they're still a bit confused as to what that truly means. So there's kind of a lot of breakdown within the band. The manager leaves at one point. One of the band members' girlfriend comes on tour, which kind of causes further friction. They're bookings, you know, start getting cancelled out of, you know, lack of interest. They start playing really, really small shows. And things just seem to get worse and worse and worse until eventually the breakdown of the band happens. But then at the end, it ends on what I think is just such a beautiful note. Their song hits like number 5 in Japan, and they go and they tour Japan and they become rock stars over there. So that's, I think, roughly the plot.
Yeah, I think
but it
hit all the major points.
Yeah, it's relatively plotless though in that kind of improvisational
way. Well, it was almost entirely improvised, I think, bar the Amps Go to 11 scene, because they obviously had to get those amps made up.
Yeah. Oh, well,
and
of course,
I think then there's the famous...
Or else someone has like a really fine hand with Tippex.
Yeah. Yes.
And then there's also the scene or the sequence with their miniature Stonehenge, which they think is 18 foot and it gets made 18 inches. Did you notice who makes that?
Yes, and I can't remember her name now because I'm bad with all names, especially in films.
Yeah, Hollywood royalty, Miss Angelica Houston.
Angelica Houston.
Totally missed that.
Yeah, I know. I had seen this film before. I think I mentioned in our intro, I taped it off the telly when I was like 16 or 17. Mm. And obviously, like, I knew who Angelica Houston was in terms of like Morticia Adams.
Yes.
But yeah. I was just, and it's one of those moments then as well, because it is filmed all incredibly naturalistically in the documentary style. So no one looks like a Hollywood movie star. And I was
totally.
You have a moment, and obviously it's very, very early in her career, before her Oscar, before everything. Mm. And I was like, is that Angelica Houston with that tiny model of Stonehenge. Yeah. And there are some great cameos. You've Billy Crystal very briefly.
As a mime.
Yeah, as a mime waiter. Fran Drescher. Now, I think she is currently president of the Screen Actors Guild.
I did not know that.
I thought I saw that in the caption for the Screen Actors Guild Awards, which were the week that we are recording this. Mm. Fran Drescher's great, man. She should be in. She has like an awful lot of money, so like, maybe she's just very happy not being in things.
Sure.
But
quickly Googled there. She has been the president since September 2nd, 2021. Who knew?
Yeah, listen, I'd be happy to live under when Mickle D goes, if Fran Drescher would like to step up, I'm happy to live under a Fran Drescher presidency. And then Fred Willard, when, as you said,
absolutely
they're
stunning.
Getting cast, they're getting ending up in. It feels like what their actual gigs are being cancelled and they're scrambling to find alternatives. And one is in an Air Force base, and Fred Willard is extremely funny
he's funny in absolutely everything he does,
where he is also largely the same person
you know what you're getting. And as soon as he came on the screen, I was like, yes, oh my god. And I wish there was more of him in it, actually, because I think he is a really good improv actor as well.
Best in Show. He's
a Christopher Guest player for sure.
Yeah, and that obviously just supposed to bring us around to Christopher Guest, who plays Nigel Tufnell, who is the main guitarist in This Is Spinal Tap. So you have three kind of central characters within the band. You have David St. Tubbins, who's Michael McKean, who is the blonde bombshell kind of lead singer. Mm. You have Nigel Tufnell, who's played by Christopher Guest, who then went on to have a storied directing career, particularly in the mockumentary genre, and an even more storied marriage to Jamie Lee Curtis. Mm. And then you have Harry Shearer, who's probably best known for being the voice of basically everybody in The Simpsons.
Yeah, we've got Principal Skinner, Kent Brockman, Mr. Burns, Waylon Smithers, Ned Flanders, Reverend Loveboy, Lovejoy, formerly Dr. Hibbert, Lenny Leonard, Ottoman, Rainer Wolfcastle, Scratchy Kang, Dr. Marvin Monroe, and Judge Schneider, among others.
Yeah, I'm out of breath even like hearing that list, let alone doing all those voices. So yeah, he plays Derek Smalls, who is the extremely hirsute, I think that's how you pronounce that word, bassist. And he's the one who's wearing like the mad metal
like
gear.
Bondage gear and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
he has the kind of the look of Lemmy and the like personality of Ringo.
Yeah,
he's extremely in a sort of pint size.
Yeah, and what did he describe himself as? Lukewarm water, that the other two are like fire and ice, and he tries to be in the middle. And then to round out the band, you have a keyboardist, and then you also have a long running gag that goes through the entire film, is that their drummers constantly die in mysterious circumstances.
One of them in a gardening accident that the authorities said it was best left unsolved.
Yeah, and one of them choking on someone else's vomit, but they can't tell you whose.
You can't dust for vomit. that authorities said it was best left unsolved. It comes really, really early in the film, and it was the first joke that really, really made me laugh in it. Yeah. And I knew as soon as that joke happened, I was like, okay, I really feel like I'm in safe hands here.
Yeah, and it kind of sets you. It is a very particular type of, I don't know if gentle humor is the right word, because so much goes, and as we were saying, it's nearly all entirely improv. Yeah. They had 500 hours of footage they filmed this in 5 weeks. Yeah. They had 50 hours of footage, and then they spent 2 years cutting it down to 82 minutes.
Yeah. Wow.
So like, this is obviously the nature of a mockumentary, and even some of the feedback that they got from the test audience were like, get new cameraman, it's too shaky. And the DP they went for was a documentary DP to get this look, but it looks so effortless.
Yeah.
But so much work went into it. And then
I think, like we were talking before about like Anchorman as being a little bit kind of like wink to the camera humor at times, whereas this was like the opposite. I felt where like all the jokes were just kind of like thrown out there, and they just like, they were floating in the air and so ripe for being kind of plucked up, but not so, I don't know, I feel that the humor, the subtlety of it really.
Yeah, I think it like, for anything to be good satire, it has to be believable. Like it has to be kind of truth first and then humor. And what makes this film so funny, what makes the song so funny is that, I mean, all the songs are completely believable as songs.
Yeah, and they're technically
good songs.
This is more, your area than mine. Both of yours is probably more musical. They are technically excellent. Like, the lyrics are
brilliant.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
But and even Christopher Guest used to re-edit stuff if, like, their fingers didn't match up in the edit with where they... Because they can all play.
Yeah.
Like yeah. And the band rides again. You know, they have toured with as Spinal Tap, mm-hmm. and then A Mighty Wind, which is one of his subsequent things. There, folk is like based around folk music. Mm. So like they, you know, these are actual musicians.
Oh, there's so much kind of really little small things that are in there for like specifically musicians that would have passed me by because I'm not a musician, but for people who know about music, there's a lot in there. Like even the early days, you know, their late 60s, 1970s. There's like a bit of a callback thing.
You see two previous iterations of the band, yes. where one is they're basically the
original,
and they became the new originals. Yeah. It's basically the Beatles, and then you have power, which is basically the Monkees.
The Monkees and are like the Mamas and the Papas, that kind of thing.
Those specific parodies, the music is spot on.
Absolutely brilliant. Yeah. I love those songs.
And even, as you mentioned, the Beatles thing of like the evolutions of the Beatles through different genres and stuff, they do poke fun at that multiple times, and even the reference to, I have to look up the name of the band, the Quarrymen was like the original Beatles one.
When they were a skiffle
Lennon
group.
McCartney.
Yeah. They definitely, they're using some name that's like similar to that for like the early iteration of Spinal Tap. Yeah. And
even how they all met, it's like David and Nigel met the same way as John and Paul.
And also very like Mick and Keith.
Yes, exactly. But something that I absolutely loved, my boyfriend pointed it out to me when we were watching the song Big Bottom, which is the first big song.
Queen.
And I was like, I was like, they're all playing basses. And he was like, yeah, Big Bottom. Mm. Like the sound is at the bottom of the register, bass. Big bottom basses. And I was like, oh my God, that is so smart.
Yeah.
That's such a smart joke. Like,
I think, like, one of the other really, like, really subtle ones I noticed was they refer to playing at the I Love Lucy Festival.
Yeah.
Which, again, like, really subtle one, but like I Love White Festival, we kind of know is a more modern thing, but it was restarted in 2002 after originally running from 1968 to 1970. Mm. And it was considered back then as this real like counterculture festival. Mm. So the subtle things like that were like, you might not even know the full picture, but like I Love Lucy, because it sounds like the TV show title, that has a humor in its own right. And then the layer underneath it.
Totally.
Like, the little bit of knowledge you can bring to it, the amount more that this film can give you is so good for
that. And what is interesting is so many bands recognize them, either literally think it is based on them or recognize themselves in a particular, I think like that Hello Cleveland size, where they get lost backstage for ages, and that's been, and even bands will parody it now. Or the other, and I think it actually is something very similar, happened to Tom Petty in a documentary about him where they ended up finding themselves in an indoor tennis court when they were trying to get like onto stage. Or the other reaction is typified by The Edge, who said he cried when he saw it because he's like, what we do is so easy to parody. But it is interesting how, and Christopher Guest says it's not based on any specific band. I know Harry Shearer toured with, was it Saxon, the English band? But he was like, it's not what he does. The nature of what he does is he observes and then he grows characters from them. And they started this band, they were doing a comedy, now they, some of them are SNL alum, but they were doing a comedy sketch show that was not Saturday Night Live, it was a pilot that Rob Reiner was directing, and they ended up riffing and came up with these characters. So they are, they do feel really like lived in, that they have grown them, and everything that they say, it's done like, because the whole center of it is the relationship basically between the two main guys.
And as which I think has a lot of kind of homoerotic, I don't even think they're undertones. Like, I think once you bring Janine in,
it's a love triangle, but who is the triangle?
Just looks between David and Nigel, I'm like, I think Nigel, it's Janine is David's girlfriend,
partner,
and
whatever.
I think Nigel's genuinely in love with David.
Yeah,
and I was saying this to my boyfriend when we were watching
this,
because I'll make any film gay, like any two men or two women.
We are all about the gay.
Look
agenda
at each other. I'm like gay film, gay undertone.
And like, because obviously it could be read that he's in
queer
he's
agenda
in love with Janine, but I would agree with you that it very much feels like that he's in love with David.
Certainly. Oh, I never even considered reading it that Nigel was in love with Janine.
But I also think he's definitely very resentful that she has come in with her star charts to help
her star charts. She's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, she is brilliant. There was, I can't remember who it was, there was another actress who I think a better known actress they were looking at, but then she came in and was just so good. And as well, to come into that dynamic is difficult. You know, it's like we were talking about in like The Only Murders in the Building when you're coming in and it's like Steve Martin and Martin Short as in the Selena Gomez role, but you're coming into these guys who are
titans,
incredible. And that also mirrors, I think, the dynamic that you have of a band, of the so-called like the Yoko effect or whatever. And again, much like the Yoko effect, it's the problems are already there, but the person who's around for the time probably gets the blame.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's one of the things I definitely did spot with, you mentioned there about like SNL alumni kind of being adjacent to some of the people involved here, was that there was definitely a few scenes where I felt like outside of the main, like more of the kind of cameo people, were not fully corpsing, but you could see moments where they were just reacting to the humor of like what was coming up in improv and all of that. And it did remind me of one of my favorite things that ever happened in SNL, which I just recommend people to look up, was when Lindsay Lohan was on it during what was called like the Debbie Downer sketch. And it, Rachel Dratch had this like recurring segment where she always used to play this party pooper who just shit on whatever anyone suggested.
Yeah.
And it was Lindsay Lohan, Rachel, Jimmy Fallon and someone else, I can't remember, but all at Disneyland. And Rachel Dratch just kept like shutting everything down. Definitely recommend looking it up. But the little corpsing bits.
Yeah, there's the bit where the documentary maker is talking to them about their album reviews. They, I think, didn't know what he was going to read out, so their reactions to that is very serious, and you can see them like playing the being annoyed thing about, you know, the band has no, you know, trajectory and all of this stuff. And then one of them is like, you infamously got a two-word review on your album Shark Sandwich, and the two words were just shit sandwich. But it shows the covers of those albums, and the Shark Sandwich one is just a sandwich with some sharks on top of it. And it's just like, all the visual humor in it of that is like, and even I love how they don't show the Smell the Glove cover at all. It's only described.
Fran Drescher basically describes it to you in detail.
Yeah. Don't we get a moment where they like do a kind of copy of the Beatles White Album type thing and it's completely.
Yeah, they do the Black Album. The end, but the
original.
Yeah, which like, Metallica say inspired their.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, really?
Album. Yeah. But this is the whole thing about this film. And I think the quote from, like, obviously, there's so many funny quotes in it, but I think the quote that encapsulates the whole thing best is, there's such a fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah.
And they have, not only do they become somewhat vindicated in the film, like, these guys have played Glastonbury. These guys have gone on tour. These guys have influenced every single, whether Metallica or whatever band that have come after them. Mm. Like, they have become
they have a musical legacy, not just
a
film.
Exactly. So it is really interesting, and like, and also then, you know, they've been reshaped as winners in terms of how they have shaped film history, because the mockumentaries was around since the 1960s, but it was absolutely popularized by this, which was Rob Reiner's first movie as well. Would probably up until then have been best known, his father is Carl Reiner, who is like just television legend, who left us unfortunately in 2020. Our listeners might recognize him as Saul in Ocean's 11 in terms of putting like a name to the face, but himself and Mel Brooks would have been just a massive comedy duo. Like, it's very hard to talk about how important Carl Reiner is to the history of TV, and Rob Reiner was his son and was in a American sitcom as a character called Meathead for like hundreds of episodes, but this is his first film. And then within the subsequent 3 years he did a film with John Cusack, Sure Thing, which I've never seen, but he also did The Princess Bride, which is, you see Christopher Guest's appearance in there, and Stand By Me within like, I think it was a 4-year period. And then he also did When Harry Met Sally, A Few Good Men, and Misery. Like, his directorial range is amazing.
Yeah, I think it's funny. Like, his diversity is huge, but then Christopher Guest, I feel like, really took the torch with the mockumentary format. And like, going into the 90s, he really has been the one.
Exactly, because I don't think it's pretty. Now, they have revisited like this source material or whatever for like, you know, short spin-offs and whatever. I don't think Rob Reiner has revisited in the same way. Now, he's a great man. I recently saw him in The First Wives Club, which I hadn't seen, and he's like Goldie Hawn's cosmetologist or dermatologist or injectables person or whatever. And then, like, I think for maybe some younger viewers, he plays Jessica Day's dad in New Girl. Like, he is a fascinating man, and he has like Castle Rock Productions, which would be his production company. And also, he's almost the face of the mockumentary, because as he's the first person you see in the film.
Yeah,
he does his intro, and like, he is the director in it. But it's, as you say, it's really Christopher Guest who has run with it, with the Christopher Guest players, as you mentioned earlier. And so you have Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and what's the award season one? It'll come to me. That. Oh, For Your Consideration with Catherine O'Hara.
And the Netflix one, which was a little bit of a dud.
I only saw Best in Show for the first time last year or sometime during lockdown, and I absolutely loved it. And I didn't know, watching Spinal Tap, that it was him.
I found out afterwards
and I was like, okay, yeah. That.
Mascots was the 2016 one, and that had Chris O'Dowd in it, which I was like really hopeful for. But yeah, and Jennifer Coolidge. But
Chris O'Dowd has made some bad decisions.
Been a few duds.
He's made bad decisions.
That one's actually, it's about sports mascots.
Yeah.
Some of them are animals. That's where I was making the...
But yeah, it is interesting that it's Christopher Guest who has kind of continued with the genre. And I suppose where mockumentary has gone is really interesting. I think one of the most probably widespread examples would be The Office. But even that, it's become quite a staple of like the horror genre as well, David, which is more your area than mine. Even like Paranormal Activity and things like that are framed as documentaries.
Yes. In horror circles, I feel you're often hear more referred to as like found footage films as opposed to like documentary, where the person intended to go out and make a documentary, but it never got completed, and you're seeing more like raw footage.
The Cloverfield kind of effect. Totally. Whereas I suppose there's some, even in the term mockumentary, there's something inherently comedic associated with it that you've chosen.
And parody, like that you're taking something and spoofing it.
Yeah, mockumentaries are interesting because I feel like we might be coming to the end of a cycle of them now. Like, because with the UK Office, I think it was probably, you know, perfected at that time in television. Like, I don't think any other TV show has done it quite as well as that. And it's, you know, it's nice and tidy, two seasons, absolutely perfect, no notes. And then the US Office did it really, really well as well, but towards the end it got a bit much.
And I think for me, looking at The Office's The Office Eye, these guys in Spinal Tap, they are actually extremely likable because they're quite sweet and quite innocent and just like absolutely love being rock stars. Whereas like there is, and it is something that it's just not quite to my taste, where there's almost like an unpleasantness at the heart of those mockumentaries, which I don't think you have here at all.
No, I think the unpleasantness here is supposed to be just... it's more of a ridiculousness.
Yeah.
Like, the unpleasantness is how obviously spoiled these people are and how spoiled rock stars are. But it's not a deeply unpleasant thing in the same way that watching, you know, the UK Office and looking at how these people have to work together and thinking about capitalism and thinking about, oh my God, I'm going to do this job every day for the rest of my life and then I'm going to die with a character like Tim or Don. Yeah. That's not really here. What's here is... parodying office culture is one thing, and it's done in a certain way, but parodying a culture that none of us are privy to but are inherently fascinated by.
And it's also the apogee, because it's heavy metal, it's the apogee of extreme in music.
Absolutely.
Between the outfits, between the music, between the lifestyle. There is no Tim or Jim who breaks that fourth wall.
No, there's no talking heads really, except for the
Martin Bergy, right? And that's more like this film you're about to see.
You feel it as an interview as opposed to the confessional feeling.
Yeah. By and large, you never see the crew, whereas obviously Marty's kind of a character in it. He kind of reminded me of your man's name, Michael Lindsay Hogg in the Beatles.
Yes.
Get Back as well.
Speaking of, have everyone seen the Get Back two-parter?
Yeah. I think I'm currently in my fourth watch.
That's
wow.
Impressive, and possibly to the level of being a little worrying.
I just kind of put it on in the background.
You've given more than a full calendar day to you.
Oh, well, 100%. Done. Yeah. I just put it on in the background now so that I can hang out with my friends, John Paul, George, and Ringo.
Yeah, it is incredibly comforting.
Yeah,
but I thought it was so funny, like having rewatched Spinal Tap after having seen that recently.
Yes, I thought the same.
Was a great kind of point of comparison, because the ways in which... I've heard there's obviously been so much written up in commentary about Get Back as a documentary and an amazing archive of just how these group of men worked together and created such magic. But there's little moments that someone was saying that if you were even to try and do that with a band now, those brief little moments of silence or when people aren't really doing much, you'd be like playing away on your phone you'd be distracted. And they all just kind of had to entertain each other. And it was like whether John was just singing some random song or
and
making weird noises.
And they genuinely find each other hilarious. I think especially Paul and John. Like they just make each other laugh. They also all smoke like chimneys because that's what you did when you didn't have a phone. You had a fag.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But there's an improv feel almost as a result to the whole of Get Back. That reminded me of just the way everything plays out.
Even how they're playing, you know, some of their old tunes or playing, you know,
other
rock tunes
and different
or whatever.
Versions and stylizing
different versions,
them,
the two of us through the gritted teeth thing. Like you're absolutely right. You wouldn't get that now because it would be like, okay, I'm busy or I have to check my emails or check my phone.
When you look at what is now kind of considered the modern musical documentary and like the serious stuff that's coming out, so much of it is a form of promotion and that like it's put out by the artist as a real like kind of maybe tour footage interspersed in between promoting oh my god this big adventurous
like
tour. I'm thinking
a Katy Perry or a Taylor Swift or those kind of big artists. But I started watching the Kanye documentary last night and it was a little bit jarring initially because it has a narrator. Like
that's interesting.
And it's really funny.
And it's not him.
And it, no, it's not
he's
him.
He allowed someone else to talk about him.
He had absolutely nothing. He had no, he tried to get like a final pass on it and he was, and the guy, so the guy, I can't remember his name, he was a stand-up comedian and then he basically moved to New York to follow Kanye West because he was like, I need to be filming this guy because he's obviously going to be huge. But at the beginning of it, it's really jarring because A, there's a narrator, which we've basically done away with in kind of modern documentary
making. It's
a bit
the Wonder Years or something.
Yeah. And he says like, and I guess you're wondering who I am. And I was like, that's so old school.
It kind of makes me think of Ron Howard in Arrested Development.
Absolutely. Like, but yeah, that kind of style of documentary making, there's a lot of different styles in particularly in music documentaries. And I tend to think that they work better when it's just the footage, just kind of, because we're not here to have the story explained to us. Yeah. That's what was so amazing about Get Back, is that we were trusted to sit down and watch this.
But I do think
grown-ups.
Some of it surely has to depend on the band, because it's the Beatles. Like we would have watched another 10 hours of that because it is the Beatles, and because it's alchemy that it exists and it's magic and it's sat in
the vault. We're also the right generation to be given 8.5 hours of Beatles documentary footage, because we're used to watching really long, you know, gaming streams and behind the scenes stuff. Like we, as
and
a generation,
there's a reality TV culture that didn't exist back then, even at all.
Exactly. Like if they tried to do that in, you know, the late 90s, even before, I don't know if you guys were Big Brother fans back in the day, but like I would have the E4 stream on all day.
Yeah.
You know, like and then have the live, the like cut down version of the show at the end. So it's what was so great about Get Back is that we were trusted. That like, okay, Beatles fans, we're the type of fans who want absolutely everything the band has touched. So just give them all of it. Now, there was 60 odd hours of footage and I'm like, release the
Director's
Jackson
cut.
Like, give it to me. Like,
and if it's
absolutely
a man you can trust to make an exceptionally long film, it might just be Peter Jackson.
Absolutely, yeah. But then with Spinal Tap, it's much more in that older style of both documentary and music documentary, where there is an arc. There's a beginning, middle, and an end. Even though the plot is a little bit all over the place, but it has, you know, an end.
It has a ticking clock as well. Yeah. You know, this live show, you know, which was never going to be in Libya, Michael. They're never going to Libya.
Stop trying to make Libya happen.
but yeah, like there
is
a
ticking
clock.
Just imagine it, 1,000 Arabs. It just keeps going on about these 1,000 Arabs and all this candlelight. And they're like, oh my God.
Yeah. And like, you know, as Paul McCartney, like it comes up with, you know, Let It Be or whatever in the background.
Yeah. Paul McCartney's writing Let It Be. No one cares. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, or when I think it's Get Back that he like plays to, I think it's George and Ringo.
Yeah.
We're just looking at him really
yawning,
politely.
Just,
like, as is our wont, we have wandered wildly off the point.
We have, yes.
Yeah, actually, what I was going to ask, obviously we hold off on our final question, which is usually what's your underseen recommendation. But generally, other than Get Back, are there any other music documentaries that you're a particular fan of?
Oh God, I'm sure there are.
While you think about it, one that I would drop is Part of the Weekend Never Dies, the Sawbacks one, which I think it works quite well because of like the culture that they came from was a little bit more rock and roll, drugs, partying, all that kind of lifestyle. And as a documentary, then there's more juicy content for them to work with than the packaged Ariana Grande, Taylor Swift ones, where it's a very like polished view of a life kind of thing.
Yeah.
I have a slight Spinal Tap moment for this. You guys may be familiar with LCD Sound System, the Shut Up and Play the Hits, which is when they were allegedly disbanding and the Madison Square Gardens are going to be their last gig. They did a documentary about it. And I went with my good friend Ailish Bracken, who's a film producer. And we went to see it in the Lighthouse, really like, I think, opening weekend. Something went wrong with the projector and the entire thing was in black and white. We didn't know that it wasn't meant to be until the one of the Lighthouse guys came out at the end, apologised and gave us all free vouchers.
Oh, so like,
I wonder if we'd have all been there stroking our chins going, bold choice. Bold, very bold choice.
Very arty.
That is a really, like, I don't know. I haven't seen it since they got, and don't get me wrong, like I will go see LCD Sound System anytime, you know, long may Nancy Wang live and prosper. But I wonder, would it become more hollow because so much of it is about the nature of choosing to end something? And even at the end, they're all at a restaurant together having a laugh. Like they're still friends. They're just like kind of choosing to go out on top. And before, particularly James Murphy feels like they become irrelevant. And it's also like him kind of being like, what will I do with my life now and whatever? And I wonder, would it all resonate? Because I really enjoyed it at the time, despite it being in black and white.
Yeah.
But I wonder, would it resonate a little bit less given it was just like, well, we'll just move on and, you know, get the band back together and not really deal with any of those issues.
Yeah, I think I've had a bit of a cultural overload of LCD Sound System over the past kind of maybe 5 or 6 years where I'm just kind of like, I haven't seen the new thing that they did. Didn't they do some like a sitcom or something?
Oh, I didn't hear about this.
Yeah, like James Murphy did some kind of sitcom. I honestly don't know what it is. I just read the headline and I was like, nope, that's actually enough LCD Sound System for me for the moment. Yeah, the rock documentary I would highly recommend watching, especially if you like, I had to Google it there because I couldn't remember what it was actually called. Especially if you like Spinal Tap, is Anvil, the Story of Anvil. Do you guys know that?
Yeah.
I've heard the title, but
I've seen it. It was part of the film festival a couple of years ago. When I was working there, and they did a live gig afterwards.
Oh God, those boys!
They blew the amp.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, or the power? I think did they blow the power? I think it was up in Cineworld 17. And also, the interesting thing is the lead singer in that band is called Rob Reiner.
Yeah, so
you couldn't really make it up as a Spinal Tap parody.
Yeah, so it's a real band called Anvil. They're a heavy metal band from Canada, and they had this really influential album that came out in 1982. Actually, really influential heavy metal album. Like bands like Metallica would be like, oh, they really really influenced our sound, and then basically it didn't go anywhere, and their lives went back to normal, but they really, really, really want the band to make it. So they're like still recording, still gigging. They're playing to like 100 people in these bars, but these people like love them.
Die hard fans.
They are their favorite band, and they're a pretty good metal band. Like I'm not a big metal person, but like they are incredibly likable people.
And it does ask that question kind of that you touched on there, where like, It's not just about being good. It's about being lucky. And I don't think it's not like sport where there's this famous quote. Is it Arnold Palmer, the golfer, who's like, the harder I work, the luckier I get. It's not really like, there's an element of that with bands. Obviously, you have to graft and like both musically and also like in the industry. But like, let's say there's no starving great striker in a garret somewhere.
But that's the thing about Anvil as a band is that there is no reason why they shouldn't have made it. Like you're watching it and you're like, you know, there wasn't this great, you know, tragedy.
There's no implosion on loads of drugs.
They all just stayed like true lovers of the music. They're so, like I said, so likable. They work so well together as a unit, and they work so hard, and they never made it. And so I think the documentary follows. Maybe it's like their reunion tour or something, or it's a European tour, and it basically doesn't really go well for them. And it sounds really sad, and it is in a way, but it kind of has like a meta sadness about it because you're like, oh man, I really wish that they would have made it. But watching it is just like, it's really nice to to watch a documentary about a band who don't have the rock star egos, but have the rock star kind of, you know, sound and to an extent the lifestyle. Yeah, like,
and talent, I think.
And talent, yeah, absolutely. Is, like, just seeing how much they love playing music together and just rooting for them so much. Yeah. Like, oh man.
I feel like there's a documentary about early 80s disco that I could make about, like,
please,
artists.
Do.
Because after the kind of like Disco Sucks backlash against the
genre racist,
and all
homophobic
of that. Yeah.
Backlash,
yeah. There were some incredible artists who just kind of got blindsided, and there's so many that I suppose it could be something like that, where like metal wasn't just getting the spotlight it was, or there was kind of enough metal bands and there wasn't really room for them, or that
or
thing,
or but. One of those things where like the pioneers don't get to be the ones who have the legacy. It's
yeah,
the
it's like you never want to be never want to be first to market, you know?
Exactly,
it's like you
yeah.
want to be the person who comes second or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah,
and then I think there is obviously. There is an inherent ridiculousness about metal, and I'm not saying that from a place of like cruelty or anything, but it is about excess. It is about more and more. So I think it becomes easy to parody and dislike it as well, you know, whereas I think the people who are devoted to it are really devoted to it.
But that's what I really love to come back full circle to Spinal Tap. What I love about Spinal Tap is that you can tell that there is a love for that kind of music.
You don't feel like they're making fun. This is the thing. And again, to kind of go back to what we were saying about later mockumentaries, there's no cruelty. They're not they're not poking fun from a place of superiority or whatever at the genre. You feel like there is a love of rock and rock music and all its ridiculousness.
Yeah. And that's in the songs that they write as well. Like these are songs that are written by people who know that genre so well. Like you have to know it so well to be able to do a good parody. There are countless bad parodies of, like, you know, hair metal groups and that. Yeah. And it would be very easy to sit down and try and do that and make a go of it or whatever. But to get it to the point where people in bands genuinely believed that this was a real, you know, documentary and a real band, to get it to that point, you need a lot of really, really good musical knowledge. You need to have a really good working knowledge of what the sound was at that time. Like for someone like Ozzy Osbourne, I think was somebody who watched it and thought it was real.
Yes, genuinely. Like, the man has done a lot of drugs. He's
done a lot of drugs, but he also really knows the business. Yeah. And he knows this side of the business. And
I think that it captured that feeling of touring, like, and that every band knows of the kind of continuing to going on and on and on. And also the when do you stop?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, can we talk about the Stonehenge bit?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I didn't know that. That was one of the jokes I just wasn't aware of. And I was so glad, because I think seeing that little 18-inch tall Stonehenge statue coming down from the rafters.
And you don't even know really until
things.
It hits the ground.
Yeah.
So basically the guys have decided they want to ape a past glory and have a massive Stonehenge, but they put down 18 inches instead
it's of like
18
feet. It's like one apostrophe
feet.
Instead of two.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Two instead of one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, which I always get wrong, and I can really see how this could happen to you, in fairness. And there is, even the manager puts it quite well. He's like, so many things go right and then there's this one thing goes wrong, you know. And then they bring out these dwarves to dance around it, and it is just like, it's something that's like knee high on the floor,
and it comes down with this great fanfare, and he has, I think David has this these lines at the beginning, and he's like, back in prehistoric times in Stonehenge there were these people, nobody really knew what they were doing or who they were, but their legacy remains. Okay.
And I found that stuff
like
is really
flute solo.
What it was reminiscent of for me was Led Zeppelin. You know,
yes, absolutely.
That whole sort of obsession with kind of Tolkien-esque England
mythology type.
And it was incredibly corny when Zeppelin did it, and it was incredibly corny when Spinal Tap did it, but both were kind of equally believable. And and then later, you know, the break of the band happens, or the manager leaves the band, and
Janine steps in.
Steps in, but then Derek is like, so are we going to play Stonehenge tomorrow night? Yeah. And they're like, no, we're not going to play fucking Stonehenge.
And he's like, just practical consideration.
He's brilliant. I think he's my favourite character. I love Janine. I think Janine and Derek are my two favourites.
I feel it's something that you could rewatch, and you can, because it's only 82 minutes long.
Yes,
so
it's
not going to be
short.
Like Andrea's Odyssey to Get Back, where it's going to take up your whole working day. I think you find different things and different people in it every time. Like, I think you'll come away being like, so-and-so is my favourite, or then this is my favourite, and things just, like, strike you differently.
I think one of my favorite moments was the mime waiters, and one of them saying "mime is money."
That's Billy Crystal.
Billy Crystal, yeah. And Dana Carvey is one of the other ones. Yeah.
One of my favorite bits is you have to,
mime is money. So good.
Still got it.
They use excerpts from these interviews, which they have, like, they have released more footage and they have hours and hours of it.
Mm.
And they were like, oh, "What would you do if you're not a rock star?" And Christopher Guest now goes off into this massive thing about working in a haberdashery and talking about hats or whatever. And they're like, "Well, could you really do something like that?" And he goes, "I don't know. What are the hours?"
Yeah.
That was like, that's the last line in the entire movie. And the, you know,
yeah, that's on the like credit scene, isn't it?
At the end of it. And that's one that just absolutely cracks me up after he's doing like this entire weird Dickensian imitation of working in a haberdasher's.
It's brilliant.
And then it's like, I don't know, what are the hours?
Oh, and then of course our drummer friend does spontaneously combust during the final
show.
Not
the first Spinal Tap drummer to spontaneously combust.
No. So it does, it kind of comes full circle. But I mean, there's like that as a visual gag, I'm glad that happened at the very end when the kind of the ridiculousness is like heightened.
Mm.
Because all of the visual gags in it, like the Stonehenge, like Derek getting stuck in that pod.
Didn't Lady Gaga have a whole thing about arriving at an egg to a show?
Yes.
Yeah, was that like the VMAs or something?
I think it was a red carpet thing, wasn't
it? Oh, yeah, something
and
like that.
And I definitely had this image of, like, Gaga doing exactly
just getting
that kind
stuck
of thing as well.
Yeah.
Because they're in three, like, alien pods and they come out one by one and poor Harry's doesn't open. And you have, did you notice as well the roadie that you see is always wearing exactly the same thing, even through multiple performances?
Yeah.
So he's there, like, basically trying to pry the thing open or whatever. And then he just comes out, he bursts out, like, at the very, very end.
When they've all gone.
Fist in the air. Yeah. And then they've all gone back in and he gets his arm caught. Like, it's so funny. Like, the visual gags are brilliant. The cold sore thing, which was apparently, like, there was this whole bit that was cut. A women's band who were like opening for them, and the gag was that they were all sleeping with the same girl and she gave them all herpes, and it was cut, I think, like, rightfully, because
probably along the lines of smell the glove.
I don't know how much that would have like kind of held up now, but I think the cold sore thing not being explained, I mean, it feeds into my gay agenda, because I'm like, it's only David and Nigel who have the cold sores, and I'm like, you've been doing kissing. I like this. And yeah, it's just, it's not explained. It's absolutely brilliant. And the other joke that I really, really wanted to make sure that I got in is the, I think it's Nigel is struggling with the small bread, and he picks up, like, so there's like olives and then there's stuffed olives, and he picks up an olive and he's like, "What's in there?" "Oh, nothing." He picks up a stuffed olive and he's like, "What's in there?" "A little guy." I don't know what's going on. He's just really struggling to like make a sandwich in this,
and, like
the tiny bread.
The circular beak.
And the manager's like, "Oh, well, you just fold over the ham," and he's like, "Yeah, but then I have to fold over the," and he's like really struggling with this. And that was one of the moments I was watching it and I was like, as improv, this is like, how are you not both on the floor laughing at the ridiculousness of this? Like, it's so funny.
And also, they're all all the band, they're all American. Like, it is not 100% for me to say, because none of us are English, but the accents are really good.
And I think we've all heard bad American actors do non-American accents.
Yeah.
And this was not one of those movies, for sure.
Yeah. I think they're definitely passable. Like, if you asked an English person, they'd probably be like, "Oh, it's okay" or whatever. Yeah. But for us, it's like, "Oh yeah, that's what English people sound like."
Actually, one other thing, you mentioned the Stonehenge thing. There was a 2-hour made-for-TV sequel to Spinal Tap called The Return of Spinal Tap that was released in 1992. Now, it was mostly footage from when they did a Royal Albert Hall concert show, but they did intersperse a few new, kind of skit bits in between. And one was the Stonehenge joke comes back again.
Yeah.
But this time it's too big.
Oh, that's great.
But I didn't actually get to check out the full thing myself, but I definitely would love to try and go back and like catch up on that.
We've lost Andrea now. Yeah. I hope you're happy.
So I swear to God, that Stonehenge thing, like I've thought about it like maybe every 3 days since watching this film. I just laugh every single time.
Have you ever
time.
Been to Stonehenge?
No.
Yeah, we'll have to do
no. Like, I mean, I feel like I have, having seen this show.
It's basically the same thing.
It's basically the same thing, yeah. But, yeah, God, it's so good.
David, I kind of feel like Andrea's recommendation of Anvil does sort of tick the lesser scene.
Yeah, so anything on your side, Kate?
I'm going to move away from mockumentary. I'm going to stick with Rob Reiner and with Christopher Guest. And when he was asked which role in all his career that he had played with did he think was the most like him to identify the most, he said, the six-fingered man. So we are talking The Princess Bride. It is, I think it could not be a more radical departure in every sense from This Is Spinal Tap. But as we said at the start of the film, this was made, you know, this was on Rob Reiner's great run in the 80s. It is a film that a colleague of my, I was homesick, I think it was when I was 13. I got food poisoning at McDonald's. Not great. I was sick.
There goes
for a
that
bit.
Sponsorship.
Yeah,
deal.
No, sorry guys. I'm sure they would no longer do such a thing. But I was homesick for 2 weeks, and about halfway through, one of my dad's colleagues, Owen, I think it was, gave him a copy of this film and said, your daughter will love this. And it is Fred Savage from The Wonder Years, who is homesick and being read to from this storybook, The Princess Bride, by his grandfather, who's played by Peter Falk. And it is a story of adventure, of derring do. You have unspeakably beautiful young Robin Wright, also unspeakably beautiful young Cary Elwes. It is a great film. It is a gorgeous film. It is very funny. It is funnier than it also has any right to be, which I think is one of the things
absolutely
you could say about a lot of Rob Reiner films, that there is, even like Stand By Me is very, very funny. Mm. Like there are a lot of things that are in there. And then even his own comedic performances, he is a very, very funny man. So yeah, I would really recommend The Princess Bride for the child in you and for the sick children in your life, that it is an absolute crowd pleaser.
And before we wrap up as well, we have to squeeze in my personal segment. Andy, can you cue the music?
Oh, what's in the box?
It's What's in the Box. So, as usual, this is the segment where I try and find something film adjacent from my childhood bedroom. And this time, it is a Franz Ferdinand snap wristband. Which,
oh my God, look at
I'm
that.
I'm going to go, if you can hear that. So they were, I'll definitely put a photo up, but they were the kind of ones you just slap on your wrist and automatically snapped around. It's the first ever piece of merch that I bought at a concert. So this was Franz Ferdinand in 20...
Please excuse the background snapping as we all experiment with this bracelet.
In 2004, just after they had released a single Take Me Out, before they'd even released the album, I remember buying tickets for their show in the Ambassador, R.I.P.
That was a great venue, man. Brilliant. I saw the Hives there, speaking of bands, of that time.
It was at that time, it was peak for the indie cool ones.
Well, I also think it was because you could just like open the doors and send everyone in. It was a very low maintenance venue.
Yeah. So that was my closest that I could find to something like music rock
that
kind
is
of moment.
But awesome. I love that. I still love Franz Ferdinand. They released a new track in the past like month. It's pretty good.
So thinking of like first live shows, can a pair of you remember what the first... Now, actually, I will clarify as well. Franz Ferdinand wasn't my first ever live show. That was Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and I am not Katie from Mean Girls.
But you love Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
But Franz Ferdinand was the first show I ever went to like on my own without parents and with mates. So
that's
there.
A tough one, because definitely the first one I went to with my mother and my younger sister would have been Boyzone, definitely. And that was, she had a friend who had tickets and whatever. I'm trying to think of the first gig I went to on my own. I think it could have been, and it wasn't the Hives, it was the Vines. No, it was the Vines, and the Hives were playing support, I think, in the...
That's
in
a
the, Yeah, and I think that was when I was about 17. It was myself and my best mate, Isolde, and we got there, and they were like, you can't come in on your own, because we were about 17, we were in fifth year in school, whatever. And my complete lack of shame started very early, so I just went up to this group of people and was like, hi, can we come in with you? Like, you don't have to do anything, you don't have to buy us anything or whatever. And then some of them looked extremely sus, and then this lovely woman like wrapped her arms around and was like, of course you can, girls. Aww. And then we were in the pit afterwards, and there was this girl in front of me who was off her bin, but she had an incredible head of like really long curly hair, sort of like stereotypical Queen Maeve thing. And I used to wear a lot of rings. I'm down to two now, and I had one kind of very...
It was for all those fist fights. It really helped.
Listen, I was a brown belt in Taekwondo at the time, David.
You don't get into the pit not throwing a few digs.
A dig here and there. But I used to have one that was like a very big one with loads of stones on it and took up most of my finger. I kept getting my hands stuck in her hair. And like, she was really nice about it, mainly because she was over gourd. But like, I was just like, I'm really sorry, I'm stuck.
I'm trying to throw my hands in the air.
Which does feel like a very This Is Spinal Tap issue to have.
Yes, very. Absolutely. My first concert was like Westlife. A friend's mom brought me. I had a terrible time. I hated Westlife. But I went, it was fun, it was fine. I think My first, it was in The Ambassador. It was either, I'm going to pick the cooler of the two. Cool. It was Baby Shambles in The Ambassador.
Very cool.
Or it was Trivium in The Ambassador. Yeah. At that gig, I got punched in the face in a pit that I like fell into by accident. And I was about, 16 or 17 or whatever. And my nose bled. And I ran out.
It was very rock and roll.
Yeah. It was an intense night, but I was like, yeah, my nose is bleeding, rock and roll. And then these this group of giant bikers just saw me with my bloody nose and stuff. And they were like, are you okay? I was like, yeah. And they were like, where's your friends? I was like, I don't know. And they were like, stick with us. And I just stuck with these
big
bikers.
Biker teddy bears.
They were late 40s, early 50s. I was 17. And they just, when I say they adopted me, and anyone came near me, they were like, mind her. Be careful.
She is already bleeding profusely from the nose, which was nothing to do with us, by the way.
Yeah. And then when the gig ended, or maybe a little bit later, I spot someone. I was like, that's my friend. And we made our way over. But they were so, so nice. And then, Baby Shambles was just amazing. I was completely in love with Pete Doherty for much of my teen years. And I still wish him all the best. I was really happy for him that time when he ate that big breakfast.
I really thought you were going to say when he ate that mouse, because I was thinking of that, video with Amy Winehouse. I don't think he did actually eat mouse.
He might have. I'm here for whatever he wants to do.
I'm not really here for a meeting mice, Andrea.
I'm not here for that.
I don't think it's good for him or the mice.
As a vegetarian, I can't speak to that. But yeah.
I just think of the time, that iconic photo of Kate Moss smoking backwards out the window and him playing guitar at her. Is that the acceptable exception to men playing acoustic guitar at you?
Absolutely. And it's one of the hottest photos in the world. But do you remember, it was a few years ago on Twitter, there was an Indie Amnesty thing.
That was
and
great,
my contribution to that was that I lost a trilby at a Baby Shambles gig, and it got clipped into one of those articles that somebody was writing about it, and I was like, this is maybe my finest moment.
Yeah, no, I'm here for the return of it's been indie called sleaze. Indie Sleaze.
Yeah, I'm here for that. I absolutely love all the
it's basically
indie
when
stuff.
I peaked, to be honest.
Same,
so.
Fully same. Yeah, different colored tights, long necklaces, little hats, Kanye West glasses, bring it back. Yeah, I'm a 31-year-old woman, but I will
definitely
wear it
have a pair
again.
Of those Kanye West glasses. I have one of the ones that had they were called drop shades, and they had a mini mic in them, so they bounced with the music. Yeah. Definitely have to get them.
Oh my God, unreal. Yeah. I love that.
I think we have gone all the way up to 11. So let's bring it to a close. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for bringing the sheer joy you had of watching this film to us today.
Totally. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah. I love this podcast. It's a good podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you. And on that note,
endorsed.
Yeah. On that note, goodbye, Cleveland.
Yeah.
That was good crack, wasn't it, David?
Love a brief movie, love a bit of Spinal Tap.
And I think it is amazing for someone who has been as steeped in music for as long as Andrea that she hasn't seen this film. And I know we've talked about it before. That is one of my favourite things about doing this. I love to hear, we've had it with, say, Sunita Apiyakarang talking about Almost Famous being the last musician to see that. To talk to people who feel like within their community or circle of friends. Oh, and if anyone again wants to talk about circle of friends, I will talk about circle of friends till I die.
Yeah. I think we have to get a possibly double episode with Caroline O'Donoghue to bring over the Binchy Fest.
Our great pal Sarah and her partner in crime, Caroline O'Donoghue, who of which we are a massive fan, call us Caroline. They do a yearly Binchy Fest where they kind of tackle different Maeve Binchy books on Caroline's pod Sentimental Garbage. And then they've also recently appeared in a Maeve Binchy documentary that was on RTÉ recently. But I do really enjoy that when it doesn't necessarily need to be this is the most famous movie of all time.
Yeah.
But it's like, why do I feel like everyone I talk to has seen this film except me?
We're wrapping up season one with our final episode of this run, but would love suggestions from folks of any guests that you think might be good to have on.
If you want to come on yourself and talk about a film you have not seen, if there's any films you'd love us to talk about.
We're keeping a long list of the films so that we have some kind of ideas if people even want to come on and want us to prompt them. So yeah, keep them all coming. We would love to hear.
But I have to throw a massive shout out to David here, who is truly the engine that keeps this enterprise going, because I might do, shall we say, occasionally the lion's share of the talking. You absolutely do the lion's share of the work, because David also edits these podcasts. So I think he is very much entitled to a wee summer break. Obviously, David, the standard has just been incredible and the guests that have bafflingly agreed to appear in this the whole way through. But we are ending on a high. And if you did want to get a little preview of our final guest's work,
You Are Not My Mother will be available on Netflix. And that's in the UK and Ireland. I'm not sure about internationally just yet, but it should be available on VOD if you want to purchase it. I recommend you do because it is a fantastic movie. I can easily say one of my favorite, Irish horror film.
I feel like we have seeded Kate through a lot of this series because she is truly booked, busy, blessed, whatever way you want to put it. She is at every festival. So we did the intro for this quite some time ago and then only finished up our Matrix rewatch and subsequent chat 3 weeks ago. It was relatively recently.
It was one that we had to do fully remote as well because of scheduling mayhem. So The Matrix is the film that we'll be tackling with Kate next week. So the classic sci-fi adventure that honestly with a rewatch gave me a completely different sense of what that movie was.
I don't know if anyone has ever compared these films before, but much like my rewatch of Amelie, I was like, the bits I remember of this are not that big a part of the film.
Absolutely.
Of all the films that we have possibly covered on this series, it is probably the one that you could say you will not run out of things to talk about on.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was super interesting talking, especially to talk to somebody who is at the sort of foothills of their own film career. It's like, this was only their second film, which is truly deranged. So yeah, really looking forward to sharing that with you guys. And then we would absolutely love to hear from listeners. We'll probably throw up a few more things on socials if you would like to appear on the pod, if there are people you would like to hear on the pod. You know, please be realistic also. I think we've done pretty well, but you know, Tom Cruise is unlikely to return our calls.
Well, if you've got a direct contact, just let us know.
Yeah, I mean, if you do know Tom Cruise, I mean,
if you are Tom Cruise.
Yeah, indeed, Tom, if you are listening to our podcast, I'm pretty sure we slide off Scientology at some point, but you know, give it a go and we will leave you go. And we are looking forward to catching you for the last time this series in 2 weeks' time with Kate Dolan and the Matrix.
This podcast was brought to you by The Shift. For more like this, check out theshift.ie.